how relevant is this actually?
For me, it's so fascinating to find out that these ancient evolutionary instincts still play such a big part in our eating behavior today. The behavioral immune system is, in humans, everything that keeps us away from pathogen threats. Possibly, quite possibly, an emotion that only humans experience. All of these foods really get us into trouble now because we've shaped our modern food environment to provide lots and lots of these foods simply because they sell. Do you know, I have to, this is quite funny. I have to be a little bit careful here. I think, yes, we have to be a bit careful with drastic measures like that. But on the other hand, we have to also be drastic. We need to do this now or it's going to be too late.
Hello and welcome to the Experts in Health podcast brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast highlights the latest research and trends in health as we welcome a variety of guests from a host of different disciplines. I'm Dr. Chris McLeod, an academic in the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences with an expertise in behavioural nutrition and public health. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Eliza Becker. Eliza is a researcher in the Nuffield Department of Primary Care Health Sciences at the University of Oxford. Eliza, it is wonderful to have you here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's lovely to have you. We are remote doing this interview today. I'm in Loughborough at the moment. Whereabouts are you in the country?
Yes, I'm in Somerset, in rural Somerset where I live. Not in Oxford, so wonders of technology make it possible.
Exactly, yeah. No, I bet it's lovely down there, but, you know, great that we can chat. And just before we get going with you know, getting into the real ins and outs of what you do, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I would call myself an evolutionary psychologist, researching eating behaviour and the emotion of disgust. I, like you said, I work in a health behaviour research team at Oxford University. There I develop interventions that hopefully help people reduce their meat intake. But I also do research on how meat and vegetables can evoke very different feelings in people. And my academic background is in biology and psychology, so hence why I'm using an evolutionary lens to sort of try and understand and explain eating behaviour.
Really interesting stuff. We'll dive into that in a bit. Before you were at the University of Oxford, where were you before that? Where was your PhD and where's your background been location-wise before that?
So my PhD was in psychology at from the University of Exeter. So that's where I started my work on disgust and eating behaviour in general. Before that, I did a master's on sustainable agriculture, so a bit of a detour between biology and psychology before I sort of went back into behaviour. And yeah, like I said, my undergrad is in biology and I did that in Berlin, where I'm from.
We love a varied career. I do especially. It brings different skills to the table, different experiences, expertise that always, I think, come into play in the sort of the everyday work. So yeah, I always think never apologise. So,
yeah, I like it. It's taken some time for me to piece together how it all makes sense together. But now I'm really glad that I've done it the way I've done it.
Sounds great. So then, can you just give us a brief sort of opening statement to whet people's appetite to tell us, you know, why what we're going to talk about today is so important to you and to our listeners?
Okay, so I'm here to talk about the behavioral immune system, which is something that not many people may have heard about before, and also about disgust and distaste, which are all ingenious ways in which evolution has kind of helped early humans to safeguard their health by making good food choices and finding the right things to eat and avoiding the wrong things to eat without the need to know what a pathogen is or what a toxin is. And I think by understanding these links, we don't just get an insight into our evolutionary history, but it also helps understand how our modern eating behavior and our food preferences are still influenced by these really old instincts.
So that is the case, is it? We still see everything from our evolutionary past influencing, you know, whether we're going to choose a chocolate bar or some sweets this afternoon. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's probably taking it a little bit far. It's possible, but it's, as you know, really hard to pinpoint any one decision that a person makes, why they've made that or what mechanisms underlie it. But I do firmly believe, yes, our evolutionary past still influences us very much to this day, and how we choose foods that we eat, or even what foods we like.
Interesting. So just to help us all get on, you know, the same page as you, or maybe as you were at the start of your academic journey, what do you mean by the behavioural immune system? You know, maybe everyone might understand each of those words individually, but what does it mean altogether?
Yeah, so like you say, we're all kind of familiar with the physiological immune system. So how our body responds physiologically to an infection. But there is also a behavioral immune system that all animals have, which just comprises a set of behaviors. You could put any behavior in there that is designed to or has the function of keeping us safe and healthy, safe from disease. And in that sense, the behavioral immune system is a lot more, or tends to be a lot more proactive than the physiological immune system. So the physiological immune system, as you know, responds to disease that's present in your body. So it will raise your temperature and things like that. Like all these symptoms that you have when you have a cold or something like that, that's the physiological immune system. But that's all happening after the infection, right? So the behavioral immune system is, in humans, everything that keeps us away from pathogen threats, from anything that could threaten our health. And so some things are also very, very intertwined with the physiological immune system. For instance, when you are ill, you will probably feel quite sleepy and you will want to sleep, and you will have a reduced appetite. All of these things are sort of behavioral mechanisms that help with the physiological immune response. So it helps to just sort of give the body its space to deal with the infection. But what's more interesting to me personally is the behavioral immune system that keeps us away from the pathogen threats in the first place. And in the case of humans, the biggest component of the behavioral immune system is the emotion disgust. And it's an emotion that only humans experience. It's one of five basic emotions, the others being anger, fear, joy, and sadness. And it's the one emotion that is really seems to be very unique to humans. And the way in which disgust keeps us safe from infection is, for instance, by keeping us away from other infected people. So if you think of people with obvious signs of infection, you know, sneezing, coughing, you want to keep your distance, don't you? You don't need to know about pathogens or about germs to not want to be near them, because you might feel disgust in that moment. But you also feel disgust to all sorts of pathogen threats, like spoiled foods, for instance, or rats and other sort of vermin that frequently transmit such diseases. And that is because it's been helpful in our evolutionary past to keep us away, to have like a system that keeps us away from these threats before we get infected. And that is the behavioral immune system.
That's fascinating. Yeah. So we don't just have the physiological immune system, as you're saying, we have this behavioral, you know, whether we go away from certain things, whatever they are. And so coming, you know, developing on from that, what does this have to do with food in any way? How does this behavioral immune system interact with food?
Okay. So Like I said, disgust is probably, I'm going to sort of equate the behavioral immune system in humans with disgust. It's not, disgust isn't the full breadth of the behavioral immune system, but it's mostly what I'm going to be talking about today. And it's most of the behavioral immune system. So because disgust is sort of unique to humans, that begs the question, what about the behavioral immune system of other animals? And, you know, what was there before disgust? And basically, disgust evolved on the basis of an older system that almost all animals have, pretty much all animals have, and that is called distaste. And that has a lot to do with food. So distaste is really just a very simple response, like a recoiling response, in response to unpleasant tastes, usually bitter tastes. And you can see this response even in animals as simple as snails, that will, you know, you give them a drop of like a sour solution or a bitter solution and they will just recoil from it. And the funny thing with evolution is that sometimes it kind of co-opts old systems to make something new rather than invent, in inverted commas, a completely new system or even behavior. And we have this when, like, you know, how our mouth is, like, we use our mouth for eating and for chewing and swallowing, you know, but at some point in time, we also developed the ability to speak. And now we use our tongue and teeth to produce sounds of speech. So that's one example where evolution co-opted something existing and made it into something else. Or, you know, on top of eating, we can also use our mouth for speaking. And with disgust, it's kind of the same thing. We had this old response that led us to avoid foods based on taste. But there are some foods that have very different, that pose very different threats to people than other foods. Okay, so our ancestors, like our primate ancestors, were mostly vegetarian. So they ate mostly fruit, really, from trees where they lived. They ate meat occasionally, but not in any way, shape, or form as humans did. When early modern humans evolved, they started eating a lot more meat. Like, that is really what distinguishes us from our ancestors. And meat has a much, much higher pathogen threat. You can get sick from rotten plants, but you can get so much more sick from meat that's even a little bit spoiled, just because animal flesh is quite similar to human flesh, and any pathogen that thrives in an animal is likely to thrive in you as well. So that's why meat is much more dangerous. And now the one thing that I find really fascinating, and where evolution really helps explain these differences between distaste and disgust, is our distaste system helps us mainly to keep safe from plant toxins, right? So that's why we respond mainly to sour or bitter tastes with this response. And plant toxins are, an evolutionary strategy of the plant to not be eaten. So the plant doesn't want to be eaten. And so it produces a toxin that is very detectable for whoever wants to eat the plant. And not only is it toxic, but it's also, it tastes awful and you just don't want to eat the plant. On the other hand, a pathogen in a meat, in a piece of meat, that does want to be eaten. The pathogen needs to infect another host and it doesn't want to be detected. So you can't simply rely on taste or any sense, because the pathogen is also under its own evolutionary pressure to not be detected. And so that's where disgust evolved. And disgust is not so much based on taste or texture or anything related to sense, like what we can sense in the food, but it's more an idea of what has touched this food, or what is this food, where does it come from? And that is something that makes meat a lot more disgust relevant than any plant foods, because meat comes from animals, and animals are in and of themselves just more dangerous and more disgusting.
There's a lot of really interesting information there, a lot to unpack, and I don't know if we've got time, but I've got a first question then. So just, if we're trying to clarify this difference between distaste and disgust, when we're using, our, say, the English language, and, we say, I am disgusted by Brussels sprouts, no matter when they're, they're on my plate, I'm just absolutely disgusted by them. Are you saying that I'm actually not disgusted by Brussels sprouts? I have a distaste for Brussels sprouts? Or is there any way that you can have a disgust for vegetables? Or is it just, the English language isn't using the right term for what we're trying to say?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's really tricky because there, like you say, there is no word that is in everyday language that is actually used for distaste. We don't say, I feel distaste towards this. And so, yes, people will commonly just say they're disgusted by this or that. So how do you know the difference? And there's one really simple trick. One sort of characteristic of the feeling disgust is that it is contaminating. So whatever object of disgust you are contemplating, whether that is disgust or distaste, this obviously only applies to food and things you can eat, not, people. Whenever you're wondering whether you're feeling disgust or distaste towards a food, try imagining a tiny little bit of that food in another dish that you like. So imagine a soup that you like, and you just dropped a tiny little bit of Brussels sprouts, in your case, into that soup. Would that make the soup disgusting for you to eat? Or would it be fine if you knew there was a bit of Brussels sprout, but you couldn't see it or smell it or taste it?
I'm going to use a different food because I like Brussels sprouts.
Oh, okay. Well, that's
so I'm going to go with dog meat. or is that different in itself? Shall I ask? Shall I do a different one?
I'll pass the question back to you. What do you think? If I dropped a bit of dog meat into a soup that you like, and I can assure you, you're not going to taste it, what would you say?
I might think then, based on what you've said, that I would be disgusted by that dish. But I wonder whether if I could taste it, and it in that taste actually then infected or changed the taste of that meal, might I also have distaste for that soup as well as disgust?
Interesting question. So that's where disgust and distaste overlap slightly, partly because they're quite related, right? But I'm quite sure you've never eaten dog meat before.
No, I haven't.
Nor have I. So we don't know what it tastes like.
I'll give it a go.
I'll pass. But I think we can both imagine that it wouldn't taste a whole lot different to the meat that we eat, on a regular basis in this country. So if somebody gave you a meatball and you ate it and enjoyed it, and then they told you it was dog meat, what would you feel then? Surely it can't be distaste, because you ate it and you enjoyed it. It's got nothing to do with the taste. So if you've got any objections, if you feel offended by this food, if you feel like you have to vomit, it's disgust.
Where I went to with that is wondering, to what extent does distaste only deal with very immediate sensory characteristics, or is the brain and the cognitive side of things involved as well? So I'm just thinking, could I relabel what I tasted as distaste post hoc, or the next time I have it? Or is it something that is just quite innate or inbuilt to me, this distaste for a particular food that can or can't be relabeled at any point?
Really interesting question. I think there's two things going on there. On the one hand, distaste, what is a pure distaste response, doesn't have a cognitive component, really, which you can see by the example that animals as simple as snails or mussels have distaste. And even it's innate from birth in humans, and you can even see a distaste response in the womb in facial expressions of fetuses. So there's nothing much to think about distaste. But yes, you can relabel or reappraise a taste of a food because you are disgusted by it. So disgust has this other characteristic, in addition to being contaminating other objects that weren't previously disgusting. It also has a funny contaminating habit across evaluations. So if I find something disgusting because of what it is, so in this case, dog meat is really only disgusting to us because in this country, that's just not a meat that we eat, right? There's nothing inherently different about dog meat to pig meat. If we've decided or if we've appraised dog meat as disgusting, we will expect it to taste bad, even though, and we might even taste it and report it to taste bad, but only if we know that it's dog meat and if we already have experienced the feeling of disgust towards it. So you will find a lot of the time that if you let people rate the taste of foods that they find disgusting, they will rate the taste as really badly, even though their response isn't really based on the taste.
I can just imagine all of your friends and family, you're calling them out every time they say something's disgusting. You're like, do you really mean that? Or do you mean it's distasteful?
Yes, I am a stickler for the right term, and then I can get very annoying like that.
No, it's good to be particular with the words that you use. I'm thinking about this now across my lifespan, or our listeners, viewers' lifespans. Are you born with this? Do you have a certain disgust or distaste response that you're born with, or is it something that you gain over a while? You mentioned about in the womb you've got distaste responses, but does that adapt over time? Does disgust, are you born with it? Can you be disgusted at 6 months old, or is that something that we develop with? And can that continue to change over time? And then I'll add an extra level on, between generations as well. Can that be passed on if you are born with it and change? So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is a really interesting topic that I think we need to get to the bottom of much more than we have so far. I mean, there's not a whole lot that we know about this, but what we do know is that we are born with distaste. Like I said, distaste is absolutely innate. You can see it in the womb and at birth, even before babies have tasted, have had the first bit of mother milk. They will show a distaste response to, for instance, lemon juice. But disgust is different. So the disgust response is innate. It is very conserved across cultures. So if you meet a person from a completely different culture, some native tribe that's been lost and just recently discovered and has had no contact with civilization, you would definitely recognize in a person's face from that tribe if they were disgusted. So the disgust face is universal, and that is sort of innate. But what we respond to with disgust, so the elicitors of disgust, are learned. And like we just said, like that there is a strong cognitive component, isn't there, with disgust? You have to know what something is in order to be disgusted by it. Disgust is an ideational, conceptual response. It's not something as simple as distaste. So you do need quite a bit of development. And so in the scientific literature, what we know so far, it seems that disgust doesn't really develop until 3 to 5 years of age in children, usually going along with potty training as well.
Okay, so if that develops, and then as an adult I've got disgust in dog meat, or hypothetically in Brussels sprouts, or whatever it is, baked beans, ketchup, whatever, listening or watching, whatever the things that you say you disgust, and it's an idea, it's the thought of that just absolutely repulses you. We like to ask, tough questions on Experts in Health podcast. And so a question that I've sort of, been thinking about is, how relevant is this actually in the modern day? Our foods are so palatable now. And, you know, compared to centuries ago, before technology and hygiene were sort of advanced to the level that we have it now, the food system is incredibly different. And so our need to, you know, to know that we're not going to die because we're having this food that's bitter, surely that's long gone now. So I just wanted to know, you know, are distaste and disgust actually now quite, are they not far removed from what influences our food choices in the modern day?
I think yes and no. I think you're absolutely right. Of course, our modern food environment is pretty safe, isn't it, compared to our ancient food environment or our ancestors' food environments. And so on a daily basis, the food that we're confronted with in the supermarket and in restaurants, that's not going to elicit disgust in us. Distaste occasionally, because we all have different food preferences. And so occasionally we will come across a food that we don't like and we will respond with distaste and just won't eat it. But I would say that the modern food environment is very much shaped by these behavioral instincts and distaste and disgust. In a way, we sometimes speak about people, certain people, as being fussy eaters. But in a way, humans on the whole are really fussy eaters. So there's a whole lot of food out there, especially when you're looking at meat. There's a whole lot of animals that we could be eating and aren't eating. The reason for that is disgust, because if a meat isn't repeatedly, if we're not repeatedly exposed to a meat and have learned that it's safe and that it's, you know, everybody around us eats it and this is how this is supposed to look and this is how it's supposed to be and how it's supposed to be cooked and this is the time of day that we're having this and all of that. If all of this is right, then we won't feel disgust and we'll find it delicious. And that's what the supermarkets and restaurants do for us. They present meat only like that. We will not nowadays see meat in any other form. We don't see into the slaughterhouses anymore where the meat is still part of a carcass. Things like that, that would most certainly make most of us very disgusted. And people who work in slaughterhouses have to become really accustomed to that. And lots of people struggle with that a lot. And then there's obviously things like the horse meat scandal. Do you remember that?
Yeah, with some supermarkets in the UK and having horse meat in foods where it wasn't meant to be horse meat.
Lasagnas, yes. So it was basically, you know, yeah, bits of horse meat in a beef lasagna, I think. And people were outraged and they were completely disgusted. And you've got to ask yourself why. Why is it so disgusting to have found that you maybe purchased and ate a lasagna that had horse meat in it? Imagine it was the same, but with chicken. I'm sure it would have been a scandal, minor scandal. You know, they're stretching the beef with cheaper chicken, maybe. But would people have been disgusted? I don't think so. So what's it about a horse? You know, in France, they eat horses. In other parts of the world, they eat horses. They're perfectly edible. I'd find it disgusting as well. But it's just because it's an unfamiliar meat to me and to you and to most of us here in the UK. And that is enough. That is enough to make people respond with absolute disgust at the thought of eating and unwittingly eating horse meat. The same thing would probably not have happened if what was mixed into these lasagnas was some tropical fruit that we don't usually eat here. That's, again, something that we don't usually eat, something as unfamiliar or even more unfamiliar maybe than the concept of horse meat. But again, would that make you disgusted? Would a plant, it wouldn't be great knowing that there's something in there, you know, in terms of food safety, you'd know something slipped in there that's not supposed to be there. But I'm sure people would rather eat a lasagna with a bit of tropical fruit that they don't know in it rather than have a lasagna with a bit of horse meat. And why is that?
Well, I'll come on to that in a bit more then. So we see in the UK there's a trend towards people eating less meat now. Is that because more people are becoming disgusted by meat? Is that the mechanism that explains what's happening, or is there something else at play?
I'm sure that disgust isn't the main reason why we're seeing a decline in meat consumption in this country and many others. I think what's happening, or at least this is what you see in the scientific literature when people are asked about what's happening, is that people decide they want to eat less meat or they want to become vegetarian because of animal welfare, environmental concerns, or health concerns. Those are the main three reasons why people reduce their meat intake. But interestingly, what happens when people reduce their meat intake, at the same time, their meat disgust increases. So I have done two studies that have shown this, where people over time have reduced their meat intake and have increased their meat disgust. It's not quite clear which comes first. It's very hard to show which comes first, the disgust or the reduced meat consumption. I take an educated guess and would say it's the meat consumption reduction that comes first. And then as meat becomes kind of more unfamiliar to people, they perhaps have less need to repress and to suppress that disgust that they've felt all along. I think, and this needs much more research and proof, but I think that disgust may be our default response, if you will, to meat. And that the very few meats that we eat, if you think about it, you know, it's really three or four or five animals that we regularly eat in this country out of God knows how many we could be eating. And it's really only that handful of animal meats that we have allowed to not be disgusting. And any other meat outside of that, even if you've never heard of it, even if it's an animal that you've never heard of, even if it's made up, you will have people showing a strong disgust response to that meat. So that can't be learned. It can't be learned if people have never heard of the animal or if they've never, if the animal is made up.
Is there anything in it about, you know, it's not just pathogen and disease, that actually people see that their own animal ancestry in the things that we're eating? Is it anything to do with that? I was thinking about when you were saying there, you know, all the animals that we don't eat, and I was thinking, yeah, you don't see gerbil on the local restaurant menu, do you? And people might have a response and go, oh no, of course you wouldn't, poor gerbil, you know, things like that. And that's sort of a quite a sensitive response, where you wouldn't go, oh, the poor potato. I mean, perhaps some people do. But I was thinking, what a lot of that then emotion ties into feeling a little bit of empathy towards an animal. So is there something in that as to why people have that particular response to meat where they don't to vegetables?
That's quite possible. I think that's a very, very good point. And it kind of leads me on to another little science fact about disgust, is that disgust comes in different forms. Okay, so there's the really basic core disgust that we feel when we see, I don't know, mold, something like a true pathogen. Then there is animal reminder disgust, which is kind of what you mentioned there. And that is a form of disgust that we feel towards reminders of our own animal nature. It sounds a bit out there. I didn't make this up. But it's quite accepted in the literature that things like open, gory wounds, for instance, when you see a really bad accident or open heart surgery, things like that, that remind you that, you know, you've got organs inside and you're just like you're an animal in the end. And you have to die. So mortality reminders as well. So corpses can sometimes, when corpses are obviously also a pathogen threat, but if someone's kind of like freshly died, so death is an animal reminder, disgust elicitor. And then there's a third form of disgust that's called moral disgust. And that is what we feel. It's a much more sort of culture-driven and society-driven form of disgust. But we feel this when there is a moral transgression. And like you say, like all the poor gerbil, it's a bit like that. If we feel it's immoral to kill an animal, like a lot of vegans feel that, then we can be disgusted by that as well. And I found it really interesting that all these forms of disgust really apply to meat, because you can see meat as a pathogen threat. You can see meat as an animal reminder because it's essentially a body part. Or you can see meat as a moral transgression because you don't like the idea of animals being killed for food. So it could be any of these things.
Really fascinating once again. And I want to, pin you down like a good interviewer or host does. Should we be reducing our meat? Is that something that you think that we should be doing? Is that a healthful choice? Is that a sustainability or an environmental choice? Or do you look at the literature that says that, meat's a good source of protein and that we have all eaten it, even if not the ways that we eat it now. And so, having it is not bad and it's even good for us. Where do you stand on that?
I'm absolutely a firm defender of reducing your meat consumption. It's absolutely key. While it may be true that humans evolved to eat meat and that our ancestors have eaten quite a lot of meat, that doesn't equate to meat being absolutely necessary for our health. The diet that our ancestors had, so many people will be, proponents of the paleo diet or things like that, where people say, and it's quite reasonable to believe we should be eating like our ancestors because this is what we evolved for. That's not necessarily right, because people like that then didn't live past their 30s or maybe 40s, and they didn't have to worry about diabetes, about cancer, or any of these things. So, and they had the diet, they ate the diet that was available to them, and they made the best of the available choices. Nowadays, obviously, we have forged our food environment, and we have forged it in a way, unfortunately, that plays to our ancient drives and desires, which we just desire in terms of food, everything that we couldn't have. We want meat because that was really hard to get. You had to fight down an animal for it. We want salt. That was even harder to get. We want fat. We want sugar. All of these foods really get us into trouble now because we've shaped our modern food environment to provide lots and lots of these foods simply because they sell, because we like them. But it doesn't mean that they're good for us. So yes, definitely. We have to reduce our meat intake in OECD countries like the UK if we want to stand any chance of saving the planet and us.
And so what are you exploring now in this area? What's on the go in your research lab?
So in practical terms, trying to help to reduce meat consumption, I am developing and testing interventions in worksite cafeterias. So I'm trying to play around with menus in worksite cafeterias and see what changes we can make there that help people eat a healthier diet that's better for the planet while not taking away their choice. So we want to make it so that every choice is still on the menu and meat will always be on the menu in these experiments, but people have perhaps more options than they would usually have of plant-based options, healthier options that are better for the environment, and seeing if this increased availability will lead people to purchase and eat more of these foods. So that's kind of the practical side of my research where I'm trying to really have an impact. On the more fundamental side, I'm really interested at the moment in meat alternatives that are obviously plant-based and that are imitating as closely as possible meat in them, in all the sensory qualities, right? So we have things like corn or Impossible Burger that are really good at imitating the taste of meat, or as good as we can get to today. And I'm wondering, from my previous research and other people's research and what we've spoken about today, we obviously respond quite differently to vegetables and to meat. So what happens if a vegetable tries to be a meat? Do we then possibly experience a disgust response, for instance, if that's an unfamiliar product, like we would to unfamiliar meat, like the gerbil? or is it not? Is it going to elicit a distaste response or nothing at all? So that's what I'm looking at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting. You must come back on and, you know, tell us how it goes. I know research takes a while, so maybe a few couple of years time or something. But what other things do you think needs to be explored in this area? One thing that came to mind, I thought, you know, I'll put it out there, I'll be controversial. With what you're saying about wanting to reduce meat and the way that we respond in terms of disgust terms to meat and not other things, do you think that there's a place at all for having anything like the images that are put on smoking packets to elicit a disgust response for people to reduce their meat? Or do you think that is an unethical decision in a way that seems to be somehow different to smoking?
Do you know, I have to, this is quite funny. I have to be a little bit careful here. I don't think it's any less ethical to put these images on meat products than it is on cigarettes. Although I think that wouldn't be very popular as an intervention. But then again, I don't think many people thought that that would happen with cigarettes, right? But you're up against farmers and taking away farmers' livelihoods, which is definitely less palatable and less desirable than bringing down the tobacco industry. So yes, we have to be a bit careful with drastic measures like that. But on the other hand, we have to also be drastic to reduce our meat intake, because it really is time to, we need to do this now, or it's going to be too late. But on the whole, I don't think that that's going to be the way that my research is going to inform, or that any discussed research is going to inform further meat reduction in this country or anywhere in the world. I think that disgust will have a part to play in this whole thing, but more maybe coming afterwards and stabilizing the choice of going meat free. And I think a lot of people, a lot of your listeners maybe might be able to relate to this if they're vegetarian or vegan, and over time, without, you know, wanting to be, they've just discovered that actually meat is quite disgusting. And I will say that for me, it's not disgusting. So while I'm saying all of this, I am still a meat eater. And I'm kind of terrified of becoming disgusted by it, because I do like it very much. Of course, I reduce it as much as I can. But not everybody will be disgusted. Not everybody will feel that disgust. Humans are just different. But yeah, I do think that disgust is probably more, as more of a part to play for the mechanism that follows the transition rather than leading that transition.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so where can our listeners and viewers find out more about you, online or anywhere else?
Yes, I think the best place to keep up with updates about me and my research is probably Twitter or X now. And my handle is Eliza_Becker.
Double underscore. I like it.
Double underscore. The single one was already taken.
Good to know. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It might look like a long line for people, so good to emphasise the double underscore. I like that.
Yes, exactly.
So a standard outro we like to do in this podcast is, you know, if you could sell your area of academic expertise or interest to the next generation of curious minds, what would you say?
Gosh, so I think for me, eating is just one of the best things in life, and food is just one of the best things in life. But at the same time, it's so mundane almost, isn't it? Everybody eats several times a day. So we all kind of think, you know, we know what's going on, and I just like this and I just dislike that. And for me, it's so fascinating to find out that these ancient evolutionary instincts still play such a big part in our eating behavior today. And it's obviously not just disgust and distaste. There's so much more, because for any animal, and humans included, food and eating is a massive part of survival. And so we're equipped with a myriad of instincts, behavioral sort of biases that shape our eating behavior for better or worse. And I think there's nothing more fascinating than finding out about that.
That's a really good sales pitch. Aliza, thank you so much for joining today. I've learned a lot and I know everyone else has as well. So thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. This was a lot of fun.
Not at all. And thank you very much for listening or watching the podcast today. If you found it interesting, then feel free to subscribe or hit like on the platform of your choice. And you can also check out our other podcast experts in sport, and you can find a link to that in the description. So that just leaves me to say, we look forward to welcoming you back for more health-related discussions in the future. Bye-bye for now.